KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Hayward.
Richmond.
San Pablo.
Yeah, San Pablo.
I live in Novato.
Emeryville.
Rock Ridge.
I live in Berkeley.
Coming up, how rice farmers in California are trying to prove that agriculture and wildlife can coexist.
I think that this is the direction of the new agriculture. I think that it has to be collaborative.
And we'll learn about the flavorful Japanese mold you may not know you're eating and the woman who brings it to life.
Fresh rice koji, it's kind of very warm. They are alive. It's like baby, it's life.
It's all about the food we eat today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. What did you eat today for lunch? A burrito? Some sushi? Well, in the Bay Area, rice is at the center of many of our meals. California is the largest rice grower in the country, second only to the Mississippi Delta. But like a lot of agricultural development, rice took away a lot of habitat for native wildlife. KALW's Lisa Morehouse heard about some strange bedfellows in the Sacramento Valley working to reverse that, to make rice farming a solution to the wildlife habitat problem.
Just outside the tiny town of Richvale, fourth-generation farmer Josh Shepard maneuvers his ATV on levees, his dog Tonka in tow. He's showing me rice fields flooded with a few inches of water. Farmers flood their fields in summer to grow rice, and in winter to break down what's left of last year's crop. But for a farm tour, we're doing a lot of bird watching.
We got some egrets, some sandhill cranes. We've got the curlews, we got ibis. We can see a large grind of geese and some ducks. Yep, big great blue heron flying in front of us here now.
A lot of migratory birds, which are drawn to the rice fields.
They use these rice fields as their surrogate wetlands that used to naturally exist, 100 years ago. Most of those natural wetlands have been developed over, but these rice fields are a perfect substitute for that.
Before the gold rush, the whole Central Valley was like a bathtub. Rivers from the mountains flowed into the valley, and then the water slowly spread out through natural wetlands. Migrating species stopped to feed here. Salmon going to and from the ocean. Birds flying from Alaska and Argentina. But with the development of agriculture, dams, houses, and roads, California lost almost all of its natural wetlands, over 90%. And now the northern bit of the Central Valley, the Sacramento Valley, looks like a quilt of perfectly level rice fields. They make pretty great, but not perfect, bird habitat. That's why when I meet Shepard on February 1st, he's purposely changing water levels in his fields, all for the birds.
All right, Tonka, here we go. We're going to release some water.
As his dog splashes in the water, Shepard kneels on a levee at a concrete gate, tugging at a few boards of lumber which hold all the water in the field.
A little bit of water spilling out now, and as I keep pulling more of the boards, we'll ultimately have, maybe a little rush of water. Just that easy.
He's flooding because that's part of his farm practice. But government and nonprofit groups pay Shepard and other farmers to add water to some fields or, as he's doing now, release it bit by bit over a month. That gives migrating birds a few more weeks of feeding time by turning the Sacramento Valley into a checkerboard of flooded fields, puddles, and mudflats. Those different habitats attract different types of birds, which need to fuel up before their long journeys north to nest.
This is a curlew, right, with that crazy beak?
Yeah, a little piper, shorter leg guy with, but you see them dipping into the shallow water there, and they're looking for bugs, they're eating breakfast, what they're doing,
Draining fields early and all at once would save time and labor and be less risky. But in 2008, rice farmers and bird people got in a room with a whiteboard, brainstorming ideas about changes farmers could make to give migrating birds a few more weeks of feeding time.
To introduce water on a field and to hold that water, a little longer was a concept that a little bit foreign to us at the beginning, but when we really realized the benefit of it, it become kind of like, well heck yeah, we're gonna do that.
Are these changes working? Millions of geese, ducks, and shorebirds use the Sacramento Valley during migration and winter. A recent study of just one of these programs showed birds are using managed rice fields at rates up to 3 times higher than ever recorded. Of course, creating good bird habitat also helps create good PR for the rice industry, which is among California's top 10 most water-using crops. The Rice Commission's website homepage features a video of snow geese landing on a field. But Shepard himself admits,
you know, there was a time even in the rice industry, we weren't the poster child of, you know, all the environmental stuff that we, you know, have adopted.
He's talking about the once common practice of burning fields, a cheap and effective way to get rid of the straw left over after rice harvest. As a kid, Jessica Lumberg heard people complain that rice farmers mucked up the air.
It was terrible. All of the fields would go up in maybe a 2 or 3 week period, and the valley was just socked in with smoke, and you couldn't really even see the foothills.
Her family's business, Lundberg Family Farms, stopped this practice in the 1960s. Her grandparents lived through the Dust Bowl before moving here and saw how farmers needed to steward the land.
If that's your mentality, if you're going into it thinking, I have to take care of all of this, then you start looking for solutions, right? You start asking questions.
A belief system they passed on. Lundberg says her dad always kept an Audubon book in his truck and taught her to learn seasons of wildlife as well as farming. In the 1990s, the state significantly restricted burning in rice country, so farmers started flooding fields instead to decompose that rice straw.
And the water in the fields, it's a great habitat for insects,
which attract birds.
So once burning was no longer acceptable, then those species could use the land again. So it's actually had a huge impact on some of the bird populations.
Do you remember that? Do you remember seeing a difference?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember seeing a difference. Absolutely. It was pretty striking. I mean, it took several years, but it doesn't take birds long to tell their friends that there's some good stuff going on over here.
Lundberg says she sees agricultural benefits to sharing rice fields with birds.
There's also that physical agitation. When a bird steps in a field, there's that mushing effect of their feet, and that's helping to also work the straw into the soil so you get more even decomposition.
And then there's the bird poop.
Somewhere around a pound of poop per bird is left in the fields. If you've got a pretty solid group of birds that's in your fields for a couple weeks at a time that are feeding and resting during the day, well, that's straight nitrogen that's going to go into the soil.
Lundberg Family Farms participate in lots of programs, so their rice fields serve conservation purposes when they're not in ag use.
I think that this is the direction of the new agriculture. I think that it has to be collaborative.
But when you attract millions of migrating birds to rice country, some will end up nesting there. That can be a problem on working ag land. In early summer, I meet up with Regina Stafford and her team from the California Waterfowl Association in a rice field that's about to get tilled. They have 2 big ATVs, a rope, and tin cans filled with gravel.
So we're setting up what we call a drag rope.
Tied between the ATVs.
And the rope kind of spins on those swivels as we go. It's nothing high-tech for sure, is it?
Ducks love to nest in these dry rice fields before planting season. But when workers bring out the big machinery, they could easily miss the nests and crush them, eggs and all. To avoid that, Stafford and her egg salvage team drive these ATVs slowly in parallel down the bumpy field using these simple noisemakers to flush the ducks.
We just had a hen flush from her nest, so we're gonna stop and check it out.
Team members place the eggs in cartons and add some down for protection. What happens to these and all the salvaged eggs this team collects? They go to a nearby hatchery and grow into ducks. A few weeks later, Regina Stafford's leading an educational program, teaching kids how to release ducks onto habitat.
Remember, they can't fly, so we're not going to be doing any kind of duck chucking, okay? Count of three. 1, 2, 3.
Make good choices!
Stafford tells me her employer, California Waterfowl, saved nearly 4,000 eggs last year. Now, it's a hunting organization, and this land that houses the hatchery and habitat, it's a hunting club. I asked Stafford, are they just saving eggs to make more ducks for hunting? She says, habitat like this, paid for by hunters, helps support all the birds that migrate through this area.
We will only conserve what we know, and that's what we all have to come together for as Californians and really try and be on the same page, whether we agree on all of aspects of it or not, but habitat and conservation is crucial.
So if hunters, farmers, and conservationists all come together for birds who find surrogate wetlands in these fields, I wondered, could other wildlife benefit from rice? Scientist Jacob Katz says, yes, salmon can.
2 million salmon once came through the Golden Gate and into the rivers of the Central Valley.
That's before state and federal governments built dams and canals, a whole water infrastructure to move water to farms and cities.
What we think we're looking at here is the key to that kind of abundance again.
I meet Katz at a large rice farm full of swans, dowitchers, and sandhill cranes. His colleague puts on waders and collects samples by tossing a plankton net into three different bodies of water that run through the farm. First, the Sacramento River.
Well, what you're looking for is movement, right? What we'd like to see in a fertile water sample is a bunch of bugs, which we simplify as fish food, right? And what you see in there is some drifting sand and a little bit of plant parts maybe, but very few bugs.
Next, a nearby canal where the results are pretty similar.
Some floating debris, but not a lot of life. Not a lot of wiggling, writhing invertebrates. This is canal water that doesn't have a lot to eat in it if you're a fish.
But when Katz holds up the sample taken from one of the flooded rice fields,
this sample is just absolutely teeming. It's writhing.
Like this whole area would have been a century ago when it was a natural floodplain. And if a salmon gets to eat from this kind of water,
it's going to get fat, it's going to get robust, it's going to pack a lunch for the long journey down to the ocean, and it's going to have a much better chance of returning as an adult.
Katz and his team found that by letting salmon feed in flooded rice fields, they grew 7 times faster than fish in the nearby river channel. He's advocating for different water infrastructure in the state.
We'd like to see gates in our levees, in our bypasses, that would allow water and fish to flow out of the river and onto managed floodplains that provide them with the food access, with the incredible habitat.
But right now, it's really hard to get fish into and then out of agricultural landscapes bounded by levees and canals. Since the water from flooded rice fields is so thick with great fish food, Katz is experimenting with the best ways to move this bug-rich water from rice fields out to rivers where fish actually feed. He says we can take lessons and hope from the success of bird conservation on rice fields and apply them to other species.
I think most people think that endangered species are inevitable. And what our work is showing is that that's not the case. And so what we're trying to do is say, hey, look, we're not going back. We're never going to be able to recreate tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of acres of waving tule and wetland. But if we understand how that system worked, if we understand the mechanisms that created that kind of abundance,
then, he says, we can learn how to create landscapes that benefit fish, birds, and agriculture. In the Sacramento Valley, I'm Lisa Morehouse for Cross Currents.
That story is part of Lisa's series, California Foodways. To hear more, you can go to californiafoodways.com. It was produced in partnership with FERN, the Food and Environment Reporting Network, a nonprofit investigative news organization. Coming up, Bay Area chefs use Japanese fermented rice to boost flavor in some unexpected dishes.
So it adds a nice sort of depth of flavor that without really adding any extra ingredients, so it's kind of a nice surprise when people bite into it that it has that extra flavor that they might not expect because it has the koji and the lemon juice added to it earlier in the day.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. If you want to turn a so-so digital image into an eye-popping masterpiece, you'd use a photo filter. It's a simple way to enhance colors and contrast. So imagine if you could do that with food. What if you could press a button and your mediocre roast chicken was transformed into an entree deserving of a Michelin star? Reporter Carrie Spivak says that there is something almost as simple. It's called Shio Koji, an all-natural Japanese marinade. It's filled with umami power to make your food pop with flavor, and it's being made right here in the Bay Area.
I'm at the San Francisco Ferry Plaza Farmers Market, and I'm here to meet Mariko Grady. When I find her food stall, she offers me a cup of hot miso soup made with her award-winning country miso.
Good morning.
Hello.
Oh, how are you?
You want to try miso soup?
Sure.
The miso soup is dark brown and smells earthy, like the underside of a mushroom.
Is this fermented?
Yes.
Mariko's company, Aiden Fermented Foods, produces Japanese staples like miso, which is a fermented paste made from soybeans, salt, rice, barley, and the Japanese mold called koji. At the Ferry Plaza, Mariko is something of a koji ambassador, talking it up to anyone who walks by.
So koji is all our product, key ingredients, fermented rice, and full of enzymes.
Mariko holds up a mason jar. Inside is a block of white rice. Up close, the rice looks like it's covered in frost. This is rice koji. It's cooked rice that's fermented for 3 days with the mold Aspergillus oryzae. That mold, called koji, is necessary to make Japanese staples like miso, soy sauce, rice vinegar, and sake. Pretty much all the big names on the Japanese table. And now, chefs in the Bay Area are using Mariko's koji products to develop the flavors in other types of food.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm Chris.
Chris. Oh, thank you.
Chris Porter is a cook at Californio's, a Michelin star restaurant. His boss, David Yoshimura, is chef de cuisine, and he brought Chris to meet Mariko.
Yeah, so he uses the koji every day, and so he was asking me more about miso and how to make it. So I was like, oh, you should just ask Mariko.
Yeah, I would love to be able to make misos from other grains that aren't necessarily used in Japanese cooking, like maybe black-eyed pea miso or heirloom beans or different grains that might not necessarily be as popular amongst the Japanese cooks.
These days, if you eat at a good restaurant, it's possible you're eating something made with koji, even if it's not Japanese food. Californio serves California Mexican food. They use Mariko's Shio Koji to make a Mexican-style ceviche. Shio Koji is a simple but powerful marinade made from rice koji, salt, and water.
So it adds a nice sort of depth of flavor that without really adding any extra ingredients. So it's kind of a nice surprise when people bite into it that it has that extra flavor that they might not expect.
That unexpected flavor is umami. Literally translated from Japanese, it means deliciousness. There are actually five tastes: salty, sweet, sour, bitter, and umami. Some call it savory. I call it the taste of, that is so good. Foods with strong umami are high in amino acids. You get amino acids by breaking down proteins. It's like what happens when you age meat. The enzymes break down the protein and you wind up with tastier steak. The enzymes in koji do the same thing to any of the foods they touch. Plus, koji's versatile. A short marinade in shio koji gives almost anything an umami boost. If koji could talk, This is how it might converse with other microbes. It's so essential in Japan that starting in 2004, Koji starred as a character in Moyashimon, an award-winning Japanese manga. It ran for 10 years and spun off into an anime and live-action TV show. During that time, the Association for Japanese Brewers named Koji a national treasure, and it celebrated on National Fungus Day. But back in the Bay Area, Mariko Grady didn't get started in the Koji business because of Koji's pop star status.
Oh, hi. Oh, hi.
15 years ago, she was a professional dancer and singer with a Japanese performance troupe.
Yeah, yeah,
When she wasn't on tour, she was rehearsing in Tokyo or living in San Francisco with her husband and daughter. As a hobby, she brought prepared rice koji back with her from Japan and made her own miso.
We begin our coverage in Japan this morning with CBS News correspondent Harry Smith, who joins us.
But then, in 2011, a huge earthquake rocked Japan. It caused a tsunami and worse.
Fears of a nuclear disaster grew today following a third explosion and fire, the largest so far, at the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant.
Yeah, I'm very worried. My friend in Tokyo or Fukushima area also. Many people doesn't know how spread out this radiation to very huge area.
The Japanese community at her daughter's elementary school started a fundraiser. Mariko wanted to make something to contribute, so she sold her homemade miso.
Many friends want to buy and then very quickly sold out. So.
In the process, Mariko used up all the prepared rice koji she had brought back from Japan, and she couldn't return to buy more. But in the back of her kitchen cabinet, she noticed a package of green powder, the koji mold. So she started making her own rice koji, and a business was born. Today, she makes 150 pounds of rice koji a week at the La Cucina communal kitchen in the Mission.
This one already 72 hours after incubator start, fresh rice koji, it's kind of very warm. They are alive. It's like baby, it's life.
This rice koji will be the starter for four different kinds of miso, shio koji, and other products. Running her company means she no longer performs music professionally. But Mariko says she finds a way to connect with a different audience.
Koji listen or feel my good energy through my voice or through my hand. So always I want to keep good energy like performer.
And if the koji isn't listening, there are a lot of Bay Area chefs and home cooks who are. In San Francisco, I'm Carrie Spivak for Cross Currents.